Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for at least the next hour before I bring our guest up on this August the 8th on the West Coast, now August the 9th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We have a lot going on in the world already. We have that spectacle that appears every 4 years that they like to call the Summer Olympics, taking place in Beijing, China. Today was the opening ceremonies, broadcast on NBC, and without fail, NBC went on the air at 8 o'clock on 8-8-08. So they got the magic numbers in there as well. Of course, the starting time was purported to be 8:08. They were actually doing the excitement portion of the opening ceremonies, where they put on a big light spectacle. They had some 15,000 participants, and I'm speaking just about the entertainers. It was interesting. It was something to see. It was impressive. Lots of fireworks, which the Chinese are known for inventing, at least in this round of humanity. And while that was going on, one of my listeners, Renee in California, thank you, Renee, sent an article that she had found regarding some war going on between the former Soviet state of Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, I guess it's called, and Russia. Russia was invading Georgia, bombing cities, killing hundreds of people, destroying just about every building in one particular town, tanks moving in, and this was going on while the Olympics were launched. So we did expect to see something. We were waiting to hear reports on the bird flu. We'll still keep our eyes and ears open for that, and I'm sure our listeners will let us know if anything is picked up, anything is heard. We encourage you to do that. But we also must pay attention to what's going on in this country. And I'm not speaking about the John Edwards sex scandal. That's another diversion for CNN and the mainstream networks to bombard us with now. They've got a scandal going. Evidently, John Edwards had an extramarital affair that's been videotaped, and he's even being accused of fathering a child with the woman with whom he had the affair. And there's another fellow that is claiming that it's his child and not Edwards' child. I almost said McCain, because I was on another show on RBN just a few moments ago with Chris Hinckley, and we were talking about John McCain. So John Edwards is the individual. One must ask why they picked him. What's going on? So we'll figure it out. It may take us a few days, but we always do. So that's just a few tidbits of what's going on, and we've got some 17 days or so of the Olympics coming up. Be watching out for word of the bird flu, the Spanish flu, because they've revived that virus as well. And from what True Aunt says, there may be as many as 100 million bird flu vaccines being dished out to people before they leave China. And it's going to continue. Things are going to get pretty hairy here. Now, the state of Georgia, not the United States state of Georgia, but the Republic of Georgia, is asking the United States government for permission to withdraw their troops from Iraq, and that hasn't been decided yet, according to what we've been able to read, because they need these soldiers in their own country for defense. I wonder what will happen if we come under attack. Who will come to our rescue? With that, I would like to bring a regular Friday guest. He's been a weekly guest ever since Evident Footprints became a radio show, and both on the old network as well as with BBS Radio. And he is a very intelligent, very experienced, very prolific scientist and inventor, an author, a lecturer, a teacher. He's a great co-pilot on my show every week, and he is just a wealth of information, and he's a good friend, and his name is Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. That was a very, very glowing introduction. I appreciate that.
Well, embellishing it a little bit with John Edwards didn't hurt, did it? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, thankfully, I don't have any scandals in my life, so that I'm aware of, anyway.
Yeah. How's life treating you these days now?
It's not bad. I'm very, very busy. My health is improving little by little. As you know, I had that problem with the legs for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I'm pretty much the same old me.
Well, that's good to hear. Just as a reminder for any new listeners that we have out there, as well as our regular listening audience, last week we were talking about Nikola Tesla. And in fact, I know that that's a topic, if that's the correct word to use, that's very dear to both of us. And your experience in science and invention, as well as my experience somewhat in research, and in a keen interest in his inventions, and that concept of intuition that he used, bringing ideas literally out of the ether, and confronting traditional science, traditional mathematics, and the general approach of creating something that would benefit mankind. And I know that you want to continue with that story. So I'm going to hand the microphone over to you and allow you to pick up wherever you feel comfortable.
Well, that's fine. Thanks, Don. Basically, what we were talking about with respect to Nikola Tesla, we had imagined a scenario in which Tesla was somehow revived and brought back, and the question we ask is, what would he think of the world today? And we had picked a number of interesting topics to explore that from that perspective. And last week we covered some really interesting issues, several of which were electric power, which that's, in my opinion, really worth, you know, almost reviewing, in case there are new listeners who would like to hear it. And we had started to talk about war and government and things of that sort. But actually, the time went by very quickly, and as I recall, Don, we didn't really get too far down the list.
No, I think we mentioned also a little bit about remote control or wireless control.
Yeah. That would have come under, you know, the inventions pertaining to electric power, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't think we really got really very far into this. So, if you want, we'll just do a real quick recap and then move on.
Sure, that would be fine.
Well, basically, you know, we opened up with a conversation about Tesla's most beloved subject, of which, of course, is electric power. And naturally, that breaks down into a variety of subtopics, one of which was communications. And I think we spent quite some time on that whole issue, the suppression of his radio inventions and the way it was given over to Marconi and this and that. Then we talked about the energy problem in general. And I know we had gotten into automation and robotics because that's where the remote control stuff came into play. And we talked about the fact that Tesla actually had a remote control boat, which he had on display in the original Madison Square Garden in New York City. That was at a point in time when Marconi was a mere snot-nosed lad and not even finished with his education. So from the point of view of just raw history and nothing more, it's very evident that Tesla's knowledge of this subject certainly preceded Marconi's. And I think the last thing we talked about really was Tesla's view on relativity, which of course was very different from Einstein's view, and it included vortexial motion and non-Newtonian reference frames and things of that sort, which are really not covered in the Einsteinian view of relativity. And needless to say, all of this was just leading up to the topic that I guess we could open up with tonight, which would be Tesla's view on war. And we had talked about, at one point, the fact that Tesla claimed that in his experiments, he had released huge amounts of energy, which he defined as nuclear energy. And he was very adamant about the fact that this energy did not come from mass itself, and that the idea that energy and mass are interchangeable, which of course is a cherished Einsteinian concept, was actually an illusion. And the energy he felt was not coming from mass itself, but actually from the fabric of space, actually from the ether and its enormous pressure that it's under. And so in that regard, Tesla had a very different view from Einstein with respect to the structure of mass and energy. And the issue of the atomic bomb and the destruction that is capable of releasing was something that he vehemently denied was proof of the relationship E equals MC squared. And he went on, of course, to embrace the entire vortexian theory of matter, which is actually a concept that has given rise to in the Vedic literature. And we know that Tesla was widely read, spoke 7 or 8 languages, and read more languages than he could speak. And whether or not he could read Sanskrit, I don't know. But I do know that he was very familiar with the Vedic writings from India, which are centuries old. And in some of those writings, like the Mahabharata, for instance, they do talk about a war that took place some 12,000 years ago between India and Atlantis. And the mention of nuclear weapons in this writing is well known. So the reason I'm bringing all this up is because many of the things which are actually spoken about in that manuscript were not yet invented in Tesla's time. But he was fully aware of the fact that these concepts had been investigated by older civilizations. And it might be very, very striking for some people to realize that some of these concepts included a variety of inventions which ultimately became involved in warfare in our time. Radar was one, airplanes was another. Various methods of propelling ships or detecting ships at a distance was another. And, of course, Tesla also abhorred war because of its stupidity. And I think he realized through his own personal experiences, as well as through the people that he rubbed shoulders with, that war is actually brought about on this planet for very specific reasons. And it benefits a very few people and does harm to very many. And that's probably one of the reasons why he thought that it should be completely outlawed. And he actually worked quite hard in his life to produce ideas which would prevent war. He envisioned robotic apparatuses engaging in conflict rather than human beings, for instance, which actually has come to pass in certain measure. Maybe not the way Tesla envisioned it initially, but certainly the concept of robotic airplanes, robotic tanks, and robotic vehicles of various kinds without human occupants are now fairly standard procedure in high-tech war efforts. But the thing that he tried to do was to eliminate the possibility of war. And, of course, this resulted in his development of the death ray, which he spoke very little about, actually, in terms of its mechanism. But he did offer it to the United States government, I believe it was in 1943. And, of course, that was the year that he was murdered. So that might be a coincidence, and it might not. But I do know a little bit about the method that he intended to make use of on this particular weapon, and it's really pretty amazing technology. If you want, Don, we can go into that just a bit and then move on. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't mean to step on your toes in listening to you, and I'm sort of reading the thoughts of the listeners. If pardon me for doing so, listeners, I'm feeling that it might be worthwhile to point out that if all of this technology or this advanced information about these technologies or the possibilities of these technologies are suppressed, one would ask, naturally, how did Tesla come up with this? And it would be worthwhile to point out to those that aren't familiar with this that his father was a priest, and he made trips to the Vatican, and on occasion Nikola accompanied him, and so he had access to books in the Vatican Library. And he may have been able to read translations in any of the languages he knew, and you can assume that the higher knowledge and the secret knowledge is compartmentalized there in the Vatican Library, and that would have been one place where he could have learned many of these concepts. Now, I'm not saying that's where he learned everything that he developed, but that could have been a kickoff point. He was, I think, as young as 8 years old when he was accompanying his father there.
Yeah, the idea of knowledge having been on Earth previously was something that I know for a fact enthralled this man. And one of his hobbies was to search for ancient sources of literature and scour those for ideas and proof of the fact that mankind's history is a lot more convoluted and a lot more ancient than the watered-down, linearized version that we're forced to swallow in our education systems today. And India certainly has some of the oldest writings that have survived the times. When the Christians burned the Library of Alexandria, only God knows what secrets were consumed in those flames. And mm-hmm. It's just an absolute sin that that tragedy was allowed to occur. We may have had a completely different point of view on our origins and the way in which our species has developed had those tragedies not occurred. But fortunately, nothing like that happened in India. And even though it's very little publicized, those writings are very ancient, and Tesla expressed a great interest in that subject, though.
Yes. Yeah, if I were to add anything, I would just say that there could have very well been English translations, too, to that material. If we consider the colonization of the anything east of the Suez Canal historically, and they were talking about Southeast Asia and Australia, New Zealand, and even India. Even though their war broke out, India was very adamant about retaining their sovereignty. They were influenced by the British, but the British had behind the scenes agreements between the British Crown and the Vatican, so it's very likely that those documents and translations could have been taken there by the British. I'm sure the Vatican has other ways of getting their hands on that as well.
Well, you know what's interesting when you bring up the British? There was a translation that I'm aware of the Mahabharata and some of the other ancient Vedic poems concerning the wars of antiquity. And that translation from Sanskrit occurred sometime in the 1930s. And it was a very complicated and arduous task to make that translation. Of course, I know nothing about Sanskrit, but I understand it's not the easiest language in the world to understand. And what drove the scholars completely mad was the constant reference to high technology and all this business about flying machines and, almost science fiction-type weapons, and they actually started to doubt the veracity of their own translations because they just figured it couldn't be. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of that stuff hasn't been publicized.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too phenomenal. But I know when I read translations of that, it was almost incredible. And I was in my teens when I got a hold of a copy of that. And I've never lost interest in it yet.
Well, the only plausible reason for them concealing Tesla's history, I mean, it's even being done today. I'm sure you would agree. The man's been gone for 65 years. And they're still covering up many of the inventions, although they're using them, but it was never given to mainstream science, nor was it ever taught in the schools. His name was never once mentioned when I was in school, all the way through college. He was never mentioned. So you know that there's definitely a suppression of information going on there. And I'm sure he was probably very bitter about the fact that many of his best work, or much of his best work, was stolen or repressed for militaristic purposes, or to be used by the so-called elite, as they like to call themselves.
Yeah, I'm in full agreement with that, and it's interesting that the papers that were in his safe, in which mysteriously vanished at the time of his death, may have contained some information concerning his famous death ray device. I guess we'll never know for sure. But the interesting thing about it is that the Star Wars program and other things like lasers and particle beam weapons and things of that sort all seem to have mysteriously evolved from government efforts, if not directed by Tesla's information, certainly supported by inferences of what Tesla had accomplished. And so roundaboutly, even if his own methods were not employed, minds were directed to look in these directions and pursue these ends by Tesla's persistence and his belief in the possibility of these devices. And, of course, that brings us right to the threshold of the topic of government. There's no way that a man of Tesla's keen mind, understanding, and accomplishment could possibly have not noticed what corrupt government is capable of doing. Now, we already know that during his own lifetime, the whole Marconi issue with the authorship of radio was an issue of great challenge for him, and he fought voraciously to keep title to his own technology, as it were. But J.P. Morgan, through backdoor manipulations, was very instrumental in causing Marconi to gain title to radio technology. And, of course, he did that with a selfish motive in mind that he would ultimately attain control over radio, which he didn't succeed in doing directly through Tesla, because Tesla wouldn't cooperate. But here's a second chance for him to achieve that end by manipulating Marconi. And, of course, Marconi eventually became his invention, or his supposed invention, eventually became the property of the RCA Corporation. And we all know who owned that. So the point I'm trying to make here, Don, is that the whole issue of invention suppression, manipulation, theft, and the denial of fame and fortune, which he was rightfully owed, was kept from him by the United States government and by various powerful entities that the government rubbed shoulders with. And I'm sure that Tesla had a very, very dim view of these types of proceedings and was keenly aware of what these powers are capable of achieving.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you agree?
Oh, yes, absolutely. What comes to mind, too, are some of the phenomenon we're experiencing right now with HAARP, with the earthquakes that we have. In fact, you I don't know if you've heard this. I think I sent you an email about this yesterday or the day before. There was a recent storm in the city of Chicago. I think it was August the 4th. There were reported 800 lightning strikes a minute. And for the duration of the storm period, there were some at least 10,000 lightning strikes that occurred. And I've seen some of this on video, and even the people, I was told earlier today by a friend that lives up in that area that they knew firsthand that some people that were in the Sears Tower were shaken in their boots, that they knew that this was not a natural event to witness it. And evidently the Sears Tower had been struck by lightning multiple times during that storm. That type of technology, the earthquake technology. Now, there's an individual, and his name escapes me right now, but I know he's in Utah, who's credited with the current research on earthquake machines. And we know that Tesla had an earthquake machine. It was a little handheld device. And he had, it's been written about ad nauseum. He destroyed it when the police came to investigate because they suspected it was he who was behind it, and he had already smashed it with a sledgehammer, realizing how dangerous it would have been to fall into the hands of government. And yet, upon his death, they probably found his lab notes on it and began redeveloping it. Any comment on either of those two issues? You know, the storm or the earthquake? Or
well,
HARP.
I'm very familiar with the earthquake device because it runs parallel to my own research, and I will go into that in some detail.
Okay.
As far as the storm is concerned, I've heard an awful lot of comments over the years about weather manipulation, both by means of high frequency and high voltage devices, but also through the work of Trevor Constable, who is actually a student of Wilhelm Reich, and looked very carefully into the possibility of manipulating the orgone field in the Earth, which has an enormous interplay with the weather. And it's very interesting and very puzzling at the same time that when I was in my early teens, some 35 years ago or so, these things were talked about quite a lot. There was a lot of interest in Reich's work. There was a lot of interest in the possibility of resurrecting his methods of doing things, and particularly strong interest in the concept of the orgone as a natural force. But strangely enough, as time went on, you hear less and less about it, and I just find it very strange that petered out when, in fact, the opposite should be happening. We should be looking into that with great excitement and vigor, because it's a window into a totally different vista, and I think that it's something that's really important to understand. But naturally, that has not occurred. And then bouncing back to the earthquake issue, it brings to mind a very interesting thing that was presented on the MythBusters show sometime last year. And a friend of
I saw that show too.
A very close friend of mine sent me a copy of the show because I wasn't aware that they had explored this particular issue. And they get on there and built this little vibrator, and I don't know where the heck they were. I don't remember exactly, but anyhow, they found an abandoned truss bridge that was going to be demolished anyway, and they got permission to try and demolish it with vibrations, as Tesla had talked about with his little handheld device that you mentioned before. And they put this contraption to work on the bridge, and I believe they powered it with compressed air. I'm not really certain about that. I don't remember it too well. But needless to say, it didn't do anything to the bridge. They felt vibrations here and there, but nothing extraordinary happened. It didn't start popping rivets and go into multiple modes of vibration or anything like that. So their conclusion was that this was just a myth, and that there's no way that you could possibly prompt a structure of that size into self-destruction by means of a handheld device, or even a larger device, because theirs was pretty big. It was a long ways from handheld. But here's the interesting thing on that, Don. I have discovered some of Tesla's lesser-known secrets. And one of them that is really amazing has to do with this very topic. I didn't discover it by means of playing around with earthquake machines, but I found it through a study of a mathematical procedure that Tesla describes in some of his writings. And he talks about an inverse to the logarithmic decay envelope, which means that when you have any kind of a damped vibration, like whether it's a tuning fork that's struck and then left alone, or if it's a free-running oscillator that's got some kind of losses associated with it, or any number of machinery types that have simple harmonic motion as part of their functioning. If the dampening coefficient is large enough, what happens is, without a continuous input of power to overcome the losses, you get this decay envelope, which slowly brings the vibratory level down to the point where it's imperceptible and it just disappears into the ether. Well, he talked about the reverse of this, where you could start with almost nothing and build a vibration that would logarithmically increase. Now, the interesting thing about it is he doesn't talk about this subject in such a way that it's like a set of instructions for somebody to follow and imitate. But anybody that really studied his work in great detail and took the trouble to put, to, as the saying goes, to connect the dots, would realize that what Tesla was talking about is a function that is capable of being produced, providing you use the right wave function, the right wave function, or the right forcing function. And what's interesting is that in other lectures, he gives hints about this forcing function. And he talks about the fact that under certain conditions, you can have a wave which actually prepays the tab on the losses in a given system. And once you have mastered the use of that type of a wave function, what happens is that the propagation factor of that wave through a given material behaves as if it's lossless. It isn't lossless, but the wave thinks that it's lossless because the logarithmic decay function, which normally prevents these vast resonant responses from occurring, has essentially been nullified by understanding it in such great detail that you can engineer the wave function necessary to overcome it.
Mm-hmm.
And you only can see these results if you apply that type of forcing function.
I listened very, very
carefully to that radio show, that TV show by the Mythbusters with respect to the way in which they conceived Tesla's theory. And they used an ordinary simple harmonic motion to cause their device to function. And as a result of that, it would have been impossible for them to have the Tesla-type results.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I heard a break. I thought you had concluded your remark there. I actually have two questions in one. Number one, I would assume that we're speaking about a standing wave, and I'd like you to answer to that after I ask the second half of the second question. When you're speaking about this logarithmic inversion, and you're increasing the power of it, are you speaking in terms of amplitude only, or amplitude and frequency, or frequency?
I would say, from what I know of the subject, that it would be amplitude and frequency, because the device was auto-tuning. And what happens is that as the amplitude builds, then the presence of the extra energy in a given structure literally cause stress changes, which change the elasticity function. And as a result of that, the frequency has to be adjusted for the new level of stress that the material is brought to.
Mm-hmm.
And if those two processes are continued in concert with one another, then something has to give sooner or later, and the logarithmic increase of the energy content in mechanical vibration causes the material to give way sooner or later. Now,
yeah,
I honestly don't know how much the government knows about, how he did this stuff. But let's face it, Don, they've got billions and billions of our dollars to play with. And there's no reason why they couldn't have scoured Tesla's writings the same way I did and probably gone out and found, you know, experts on this subject to concentrate on solving the issue. And they may have rediscovered the Tesla forcing function. If they did, then these earthquake machines that you were talking about become a very potent reality.
Yeah, I would presume, and you know, I don't have proof of this, but if I intuited this, I would presume that not only do they have his technology, but they've been able to adapt it to other methodologies, and it could have to do with,
sure,
with directed energy devices, and whether that's laser or pulse beam weapons, or, and I call them weapons because they're destructive. What you just explained about that the phenomenon that occur makes sense in that, you know, an earthquake, there was a point in my career where we were actually doing work for a movie, and we were trying to create for a THX system in a theater, the multi-speaker systems that are used, and before they started calling it surround sound. And the THX system is split up into a speaker array based on delay from one point to the next, and some filtering involved in it where certain frequencies go to certain speakers at a certain time. And so it gives you the viewer in the theater the impression that they're right there where the action is taking place, even though they're looking at a two-dimensional screen. The sound becomes three-dimensional, makes it appear to be more realistic. And the problem that we had, and I know that Altec Lansing was working on the drivers for the system that was used, was producing the frequency of an earthquake. They're about 2 hertz on average. So we're talking about 2 cycles per second, for those that aren't familiar, or a rise and fall in the sound wave above and below and below the median line in the middle that would be a null point. So the number of times that curve rises and falls per second determines the frequency. Now, the harmonics, if it produces harmonics, then you are going to get destruction on land. In other words, buildings are going to crumble. So would the movement of the earth is one thing, but I would postulate that the harmonic frequencies that ride along that standing wave contribute to much of the damage that occurs on the surface. What's your feeling on that? I might be totally wrong, but
no, I don't think you're wrong. I don't know the way in which these forces combine, you know, to cause the total effect of an earthquake, because actually that's way out of my field. But I do know this. Animals are sensitive and know that an earthquake is coming long before the actual force of the quake reaches their vicinity. And that suggests to me that the higher frequencies above the actual turbulence of the plate movements are in fact projected ahead as higher harmonics from the fundamental, let's say, 2 or 3 cycle per second wave. Now, what's interesting about that is these waves, it's already well known, have enormous capability for traversing huge distances without losing very much of their power. And two animals that I'm well aware of that make use of this are the elephant and the whale. They both can hear subharmonics, you know, very, very low, below the normal hearing level of human beings, for instance. And they actually communicate with each other using these waves. And so, obviously, if they can hear each other make these sounds, I mean, the whales communicate literally thousands of miles apart. They know, I don't know exactly what they know, but they've been measured as actually sending information back and forth to each other at great distances using these ultra-low frequencies. And elephants definitely do this in a medium that's much less efficient for the transmission of sound, because water is many times denser than air. And they can do this across great expanses.
Mm-hmm.
So
I vouch for that. Even in metaphysics, whales, porpoises, and dolphins are known to do this into the ether, into other dimensions.
Well, I wouldn't doubt any of that, because unfortunately, we humans think we know it all, and we're just a little speck on the knowledge scale. And who can say what some of these other wonderful creatures are capable of doing?
Mm-hmm.
It's just a shame that we decided to slaughter these animals for food and something as idiotic as oil for lamps, rather than study them and befriend them, which is what I think the Creator had in mind for us to do. And I'm particularly ticked off about the way we've treated elephants, simply because of the fact that I've always loved those animals ever since I was a child. But anyway, we're getting pretty far afield from the subject matter. The fact is that these vibrations are capable of enormous traveling through distance and without very much dispersion. And there are living creatures that make use of them. So it's not impossible for us to make these measurements now electronically, to detect and measure the frequencies and amplitudes and the effects that they have as they move through various mediums. And because of the diseased minds that direct the R&D in various war efforts and war laboratories, naturally the first thing they would look for is a way of using it to kill someone or hurt someone. So if you put all that stuff together with the realization that the billions of dollars they steal from us every year are also funding these efforts, it makes perfect sense that they might have come up with a weapon.
Yeah, and you know, it's not just me. There are folks around the world that are intuitive, that say the same things in terms of, is it the Earth doing this on its own, or is it man doing it to the Earth? And this Chicago storm that I brought up is one particular example, as well as the earthquakes that have been occurring. I think there's a combination of the two. But there's usually a political motive for a certain area being or becoming victimized by tsunamis and earthquakes and the wanton destruction. There's always a message being sent to, you know, it's political in nature is what I'm saying.
Well, let me tell you, I'd like to answer that comment with this remark. You know, a lot of these people start to feel like little demigods when they get in control of weapons of unusual power. I mean, when we were the only ones with the A-bomb, it was a big deal, and we were running around with a feather in our cap. And they're very annoyed when the Russians got it and the Chinese got it. Now almost everybody of any consequence has the darn thing. But the point is this, you know, the Earth as an organism will only take so much abuse. The legends that describe the destruction of Atlantis actually say that the reason why the continent disappeared was because of the fact that certain devices, which were in use at the time, when they went to war with the rest of the world, which is really what they did. I mean, they started simultaneous wars with several of the largest civilizations on the planet, you know, at the close of the last ice age. And apparently those places were India, Greece, Egypt, different areas where they wanted to have dominance. But somehow, in the course of doing all of this, they were setting up possibly similar scenarios with vibrations and crystals and all sorts of technology that we can't necessarily imagine today. But the legend really says that in the process of destroying others for their own purposes, the Earth rebelled, and some of the effects that they were using to hurt other people backlashed upon themselves, and the entire continent readjusted, which was a major calamity for them. And I don't think that these legends should go disregarded, because this planet is not just a hunk of rock, and I have said this a million times, both on your shows and in other aspects of my life, Don, and the fact goes that these people may feel very supreme in their ability to manipulate these forces and cause destructions and what have you, and then laugh and snicker behind the scenes because nobody realizes that they did it, except them. And they pat each other on the back and feel like they really accomplished something, because mm-hmm. now they can kill more efficiently in a new way, and nobody knows that they're doing it. Mother Nature gets the blame. Well, one of these times, they're going to try something new and exciting that's going to have real negative repercussions, and God help all of us when that happens. I think this planet is far too complicated, and the forces that guard its integrity are well established. And we can only go to certain extremes before we start to see some type of negative repercussions. Don't you agree?
Yes. In light of your comments about Atlantis, there was the ruler of Atlantis, and this individual or this entity is known as a god of sorts, and of a negative nature, I would say, an antithesis of the god that we know as the creator of the universe. His name was Thoth, and he was into pyramidology, alchemy, and crystals, and all the things that you see people gaining an interest in today. There's a parallel going on. The pyramids themselves were part of this whole belief system. But it was more than just a belief system. It, you know, the technology followed it, and it was multidimensional, much like what's going on today. I see everything being mirrored today, in a sense. The difference is that the society, I think, was more aware of all of the technology during the days of Atlantis, and I think that. Now, today, people, maybe through the internet and the advanced, the speed of communication, the whole world is being made aware of it. Although the governments that are conspiring together, like you're describing, for their greed and just to maintain power and control over the sheeple, as they like to call us, the eaters, the worthless eaters, the cattle, as Henry Kissinger would call us, They're relying on the propaganda to keep us unaware of what's going on. And yet, if I look at what's going on, it's parallel to what went on in Atlantis. Anything that I could deduce from my studies, anything I've read historically, the things you're talking about, it all falls into place. Do you have a comment on that? And are you familiar with Thoth?
I'm not familiar with that particular individual, but that may have come at the very last sequence in the Atlantean history. I was more enthralled with the benevolent Atlantis that existed before the first series of destructions occurred. Atlantis was actually destroyed in two or three movements. It didn't happen immediately. But initially, Atlanta was ruled by 10 kings that each governed a different area of the Atlantean continent. And after the first destruction, the continent literally split into two huge islands. It wasn't just the one, you know, continuous landmass that Plato talks about. It actually broke up into the main island of Atlantis and a secondary island called Poseidon. And, you know, its history after that is really pretty much lost in time. But I think that the invasion of Europe, particularly Greece and the Mediterranean countries, by the Atlanteans, was probably at very close to the end of their existence, because I think that the war campaigns that they were actually involved with were going on while the motherland disappeared. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why you've got Atlantean influence all over the place. You had ships sailing as far away as India and God knows where else. Egypt, in their own writings, talk about having been colonized by Atlantis. And, of course, there's so much proof that this is so that it's unbelievable, and yet the Egyptian government will never, ever release some of the more fantastic things that they have found supporting this concept. And, you know, it just goes down in history as a legend that was reported by Plato and other people. But the fact of the matter is, my internal feelings tell me that it was a very real place, and the ruins that are left all over the world certainly support the fact that there was another era in which a different type of construction, a different type of science, and a different type of civilization ruled this planet. But the most important thing to remember is civilizations come and go, and power is an illusion, because no matter how powerful you are, you're never going to be as powerful as the being that created all this stuff. And entire civilizations, governments, technologies, and what have you can be wiped away with the blink of an eye. And we should be very humbled by that, and we should direct our energies towards constructive and worthwhile things instead of all of this nonsense. That's only me talking, Don. What do I know?
Yeah. Well, we covered Atlantis a little bit. That was interesting. I know someone personally. Actually, she has passed away a few years ago. Dr. Elizabeth Bacon was asked to read an artifact that a doctor who was vacationing in an area of the Bermuda Triangle found a pyramid, a crystal pyramid, when he was scuba diving. And he had various psychics look at this device, hold it, and try to give him some account for how it was created and what its significance was. And I had known Dr. Bacon back in 1982. I met her and spent several hours with her talking about my life and things that were happening to me on a spiritual level. And she had actually been the person who was able to deduce who had created this and who it was associated with. And the name that came out was Thoth, the very entity that I mentioned. I found that to be very intriguing. I learned this about this event about 2 years ago. So it's interesting that this information comes out in a variety of ways, and I have no reason to doubt what Dr. Bacon said.
Well, in parallel to what you just said, and even in support of it, I would like to point out that the great sleeping prophet, Edgar Cayce, talked about the fact that, I believe it was to be in the 1980s, he saw Atlantis rising. And, you know, people started scouring the Bermuda Triangle area and what have you, looking for clues to a sunken continent coming back. And it was during that effort that they found the so-called Bimini Wall, which has never really been archaeologically investigated very thoroughly. But my feeling, my take on his remark, was that it didn't necessarily mean that we were going to see a resurgence of a submerged continent, but rather that we were going to see a almost a duplication, because of the laws of karma, of the same types of things that happened in the Atlantean era. And this is where I think things are headed. I mean, all these things are being discovered, all these things are being done that have obviously been done before, and they're being done illegally and immorally for very selfish purposes. And this is the reason why you see the parallels between the legends of Atlantis and some of the things that are happening in the world today. And the thing that I feel is, not only are we going to have parallels in the R&D and in the development of these weapons and in the secret use of them, but if we're not careful, we're going to see a parallel in the conclusion of these things.
Well, That's sort of like mankind just cycling through the same mistakes over and over, repeating the mistakes, as if we're trapped in a time loop. I think what may happen is time is collapsing in a sense, and dimensions are merging, and so it could also come about via that process. What's your feeling on that?
Well, if you're referring to the great, the end of the Mayan calendar and the great disturbance that's supposed to come upon us at that point in time, we should remember that 2012 is not too far away. And, what it represents, I don't pretend to know. But as you and I have discussed on many shows together, there's a distinct possibility that it is some type of event which is going to cause an explosion of consciousness. And if that happens, you know, it could be interpreted as being the end of the world, in the sense that with truly expanded consciousness in the minds of a very large number of people, the world as we know it is certainly going to come to an end, and there would be positive changes, which would mean that a lot of the stuff that's been going on under the table will come to an end. That's one interpretation. You know, the other interpretation, as we've talked about, could mean that there's going to be some huge planetary or perhaps even galactic disturbance, which can affect everything, not just our planet, but perhaps the whole solar system. And that the churning up of all of these forces could have very great ramifications both on the physical plane and in the spiritual and mental areas as well.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, it certainly suggests something big is coming.
Yeah. Well, I've always maintained that the truth is withheld from us to prevent the expansion of our consciousness. And that expansion is occurring nevertheless, which is why we see everything being ramped up into overdrive now. So these changes are going to be inevitable one way or the other. They're either going to lead to a higher consciousness or the lowest frequency, which is going to bring us to total destruction. And still there is a lack of understanding and a certain arrogance on the part of those that feel that they're totally in control, and they may be to some extent, but the very fact that we're able to talk about it is an indication that they haven't gotten complete control. And we can talk about it with our thoughts when they want to stop our mouths from moving and our fingers from moving across the keyboards. So I'm ranting a little bit, but I'm sort of reiterating what you just said, that these things are going on, and they are much, much greater than any of us. Yet the understanding and the ability to integrate these changes into our consciousness always remain a possibility. And I'm wondering what how Tesla would see that, knowing if he were here now and he could see these changes taking place. It would be interesting what invention he would come up with to stop this madness.
Well, I don't know if he'd have an invention or not, but I think he would obviously see and understand the hallmarks of this type of activity. And his greatest contribution might be to get on his soapbox and start explaining to people what's actually going on behind the scenes. And he was just tenacious enough and strong-willed enough that he might do that despite the potential threat to his own existence. But now that you've gotten back on the subject of Tesla, let me point out this.
You like that.
Yeah, I mean, we come full circle, which is great, but I mean, since you brought it up about, you know, what Tesla would think of all this, one of the things that he cherished the most was the fabric and the quality of his mind. That's very evident from his writings and from the way he spoke and what have you. And he had a very superb education. And that brings us to the absolute disaster of the educational system in our country nowadays. This TV show that's on, I forget the exact name of it, but it's something to do with can you outwit a fifth grader or something to that effect.
Something like, are you as smart as a fifth grader?
Yeah, whatever it's called, you know. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, but it's really amazing to see how many people get confronted with, you know, questions which they can't answer. They don't know the first thing about it, and some of the fifth grade kids that they're up against have no problem with that. Well, if that isn't enough of an indication that things are not quite right, if you go into the technical realm and you look at the curriculums that were required of engineers training in Tesla's day and compare them to what modern engineers today are scheduled to learn, it is just unbelievable how different it is. I mean, in the subject of mathematics alone, the fluidity in such subjects as algebra, calculus, differential equations, elliptical trigonometry, differential geometry, and only God knows what else. And these types of things were required as standard education just to get the most fundamental of degrees. Nowadays, the information that you have to have mastered to get a Bachelor of Science degree, for instance, is nowhere near that level. And you don't start to encounter some of that stuff until you go into the very advanced doctoral areas where the work is so complicated that you're forced to master some of these long-forgotten topics, and they are looked upon as a speciality rather than general education. And that's just in mathematics. You know, we've got physics, we've got chemistry, we've got biology, we've got all these other fields where the same thing is occurring. If they're so watered down and the standards are so eroded that it's just a crime. But here's one of the most interesting things, Don, and I have often thought we should do a whole show on this subject, is the massacre of the English language. It is just amazing. if you listen to the way ads are written and to the way people use verbs and adverbs, I think the adverb is disappearing from the English language. Nobody knows what the heck to do with them anymore. It's just unbelievable. And these are just changes I've noticed in my few years. Just imagine if we double or triple that. In law, for instance, if you go back just to the point of the our rebellion with England and the Revolutionary War, people of that time period were expected to know so much law and understand governmental structure to the point where it was almost second nature for them. And they could handle themselves because they were all lawyers. There was no need for attorneys, you know, and there's a very big distinction to be made between a lawyer and an attorney. Anyone who studies the law is a lawyer. You know, you don't need a sanction from a university to acclaim you as a lawyer. If you know the law, you are a lawyer. Whereas an attorney is a whole different ballgame, as we all know, and I don't want to go there right now. But the point is that every aspect of our lives and education have been eroded to the point where it's not even recognizable. And I think Tesla would be appalled at this development. And I don't even know how to put it any more succinctly than that.
Well, my research has led me, and even today it continues, when I'm looking for rather mundane topics, I keep running into establishments like MIT that are totally under the control of the Pentagon. And so the scientific advances that could be used to the benefit of the populace are given to the military-industrial complex and used to murder people, to kill people, to control the whole system. And so there are some privileged few that may be getting some of this information that you're talking about, which is generally repressed, but that's a select few. And when they are privy to that standard of education, and I'm not even implying that they're getting everything that you're suggesting in terms of knowledge, but it's a program, it's a predetermined pathway that's going to keep them reined into the efforts that they're focused on. If they're developing a weapon system or a communication system, they're going to work within the rules that they have been, or the laws that they have been exposed to. Now, some of them may break out of that, and that happens all the time. Do you think it's a coincidence that the Earth has lost within the last year, or maybe it's within the last 2 years, some 150 or more biologists have all been explained away as committing suicide? What are they learning? And then is it a coincidence that they're promoting or promulgating through the media these terrorist stories about bioweapons and pandemics of flu? Bird flu, swine flu, Spanish flu, is that an accident that these biologists died? In other words, they produced the results, let's get rid of the evidence, and so bye-bye. It's all being used for nefarious purposes is what I'm getting at, if there is any advanced knowledge. And it's the same in the space industry.
We know that.
Yeah. So, but in general, and I know you're speaking in very basic general terms, they're producing people. You want to talk about math skills, and I've seen this numerous times or heard the stories from people where they go into a regular fast food place and they can't make, you know, a few cents change. They can't calculate what coins to take out of the drawer to give, you know.
Yeah, I don't doubt it at all. I heard a thing just the other day that made my blood boil, and that was that some of the more advanced programs are now not even teaching mathematics and reading.
Oh, yes, I've heard that, too. Yeah, they're actually forbidding the teaching of comprehension of letters and numbers.
Well, I mean, you're definitely going to have sheep pretty soon if that ever takes root.
Nah.
Yeah, I wish it were funny, but it isn't.
Well, you know, it looks pretty bleak, but then again, okay, now we're talking about, you know, all of this, and, you know, most people, this popped up a few times in my mind while you were talking, especially in the first segment of the show. You had brought up the concept of Tesla's interest in electricity. Most people think about electricity. They think, in their mind, of plugging an appliance into the wall. I mean, that's their familiarity with electricity. Could you touch upon, briefly, give us an overview of some of the devices or some of the applications of electricity that would benefit us right now if there was research being done in those areas or if there were some inventions allowed to come out on a mass scale to solve some of our...
I could go on for another 4 or 5 hours answering that one, believe me. I mean, electricity, of course, by its very nature, associates itself with everything in creation. So, you know, there's very little that the controlled disturbance of electrical forces doesn't affect. You know, it's somehow involved even with the life process, so... To answer your question, I mean, my gosh, we'd have to create several subcategories to explore, but by way of technological advances, for instance, that go beyond plugging something into the wall, I mean, in order for that hole in the wall to produce its miraculous effects, you know, there's an enormous variety of technological achievements behind lighting your lamp or turning on your TV, and it goes all the way back to places like Boulder Dam, for instance, or, you know, any other number of generation centers around the country. And, of course, it involves transmission over the grid and control by computers and all kinds of stuff that ties it all together. But the benefit that we could have would be a system where enormous volumes of precious items like coal, wood, various types of oils, or even nuclear elements would not have to be consumed in enormous quantity on a continual basis just to produce the distribution of electric power that we grace our homes with. You know, Tesla offered the world a source of endless power 100 years ago. And simply because of the fact that the magnates of the time decided that they liked his original discovery of a polyphase generation system and distribution system, and they had already invested in that, they said, well, there's no way we're gonna forsake our existing investment and help you introduce a brand new system which would short circuit our profits.
Mm-hmm.
I used that term deliberately. And so we were denied access to a technology which would have given the Earth enormous advantages in terms of copious power at no real cost. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, anything and everything that you can relate to the three basic aspects of the concept of electricity, which would be particle motion, electromagnetic wave motion, and or electrostatic fields, touches on every aspect of our lives. I mean, the topic that you brought up is almost endless. But you did kind of inadvertently focus on one area that might be worth talking about. You and I both know that the entire pharmaceutical industry is an absolute farce. I mean, there are drugs
really?
Which are...
really?
Yeah, really. There are drugs which, of course, are beneficial in times of crisis when life is at stake and when, you know, there are special circumstances that you just have to do. You have to take these elements into your body in order to keep you from dying or whatever. But in general, the philosophy that governs the whole thing is perverted. Because instead of achieving a cure, they just want to initiate a set of circumstances which address symptoms only and ensure the continual consumption of their products.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't really give a darn about your health, your longevity, or anything else. If a sheep dies, you know, so what? There's plenty more. And the milking process continues. However, Tesla was not necessarily the only pioneer that considered the possibility of electricity being used to engender good health. He messed around with this. He wrote about this. But there have been literally thousands of people who have noticed that under various conditions, an electric current of the right type, the right frequency, the right type of application to the body, et cetera, can have any number of beneficial effects. And this is an area that you would think would be just brimming with investigators. But obviously this is not the case.
Isn't it true, Jim, that the MRI machine, magnetic resonance imaging, is based upon Tesla's coil and his research?
Well, it's certainly based on the use of electromagnetic interactions with the living organism. There's no two ways about that. And some of the very early principles that made use of this concept endeavored to cause a change in the stability of an atomic structure, whether it was in a living being or not. And then when it was allowed to settle back to its normal state, it emits the extra energy that was put into it from the external magnetic field as a pulse of light to allow the electrons to re-seek their initial orbits. And that light carries with it information concerning the nature of the disturbance and the condition of that atom. So that was, I'm trying to remember the name of that particular type of investigation. It'll come to me. But that was done initially in various analytical approaches in chemistry and physics, but it eventually made its way into biology. And now, as you know, some of the magnetic imaging that they are capable of producing is absolutely astounding. They can go through the body literally as if it was sliced into 1,000 parts, and they can stack these parts in computer files and put the images on screens so that you can literally start at the feet and walk your way right up through the human body inch by inch and look at cross-sectional areas and decide to take, you know, some sections out and enlarge them and do all these various things with them, which are almost magical in their ability for analytical precision. It's just a shame that after the guy says, oh, yeah, here's the problem right here, they usually have two recommended solutions. Stuff you full of pills, radiation, or some other nonsense, or let's cut you open and take it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are the two major remedies that are recommended.
Yeah, I was going to suggest that probably the first beneficiary of that information ends up being the drug companies, because they know enough about what interactions to or reactions to expect when inducing a certain type of a drug of a certain color into the corresponding physical counterpart. This is how they can produce what do you call them, medications that cause one's certain body part, the male body part, to grow or to suppress sexual desire, or to increase it in both male and female. You know, the list is endless. As long as they come up with a three-letter name for it. You know, something that doesn't necessarily rhyme with FBI, CIA, CDC, but comes close.
Well, there's no end to the abbreviations that are used in all of these situations and conditions. God only knows how many of those there are.
Mm-hmm.
But the point I was leading to is that we have some of these fantastic diagnostic devices, which are non-invasive. I mean, you don't have to cut somebody open anymore to get a pretty good idea of what's going on. You would think that the natural consequence of that type of investigation would lead to an equally elegant manner in which human disease could be eased and suffering diminished, perhaps by electrical means or by radio waves of some sort, or, you know, something of that sort, that's on an equal par with the analytical capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
But
well,
instead,
Go ahead.
But instead, you know, they resort back to stuffing you full of peculiar ingredients, which is very interesting, considering the fact that most of that crap is dirt cheap when it's mass-produced, and people don't have any realization. I remember when I had the fungal infection in my intestines, and I can't remember the name of the pill that they prescribed, but it was an antifungal. It began with a D. I can't think of the name of it now. But anyway, whatever it was, $25 a pill. $25! Now, you're not going to tell me that when this stuff is mass-produced in the gigantic vats where the stuff is mixed, blended, and emulsified, compressed, and encapsulated by computer-controlled devices with only one or two morphodites running the controls in a gigantic plant and pills coming out in every direction, that there's any way in God's green earth that stuff costs $25.
Usually, it's not even 2.5 cents. You know,
right.
The markups on some drugs I've seen within the last year have exceeded 57,000%. I mean, that's insanity, and it goes beyond the meaning of the word greed. I don't know what you would call it. It's beyond that.
No, I don't know either. But it's amazing, and. These institutions are, you know, the nuclei of a lot of the income that the system uses for its own purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just an endless rotary cycle that we're enmeshed in the middle of. But,
well, now you brought up the, if I can interject here quickly, you brought up the aspect of how it's, how these diseases are, I'm using that word in a general sense, how medical problems of one sort or another that might be diseases or just merely things that are out of alignment on a homeopathic scale, there are those in the homeopathic world, natural medicine, herbology, and homeopathic methods, such as music. For instance, that's the very area I'm working in music. That's some of the work I'm involved in with Dr. Len Horowitz as well, with putting setting music to the proper frequencies so that we can affect healing on a natural level that can enable the body to heal itself, what it was intended to do. Now, obviously, that's something that they don't want to happen, but music has an impact on people anyway, and they use it more for negative purposes. They control the music industry to herd the people to the slaughterhouse, in essence. I'm using it as a metaphor, but that's how it's historically used.
Yeah, you're beginning to break up, Don. Can you still hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Well, it's that happens when we speak the truth.
Yeah, well, that's true. And
music,
yeah, I know exactly what you mean. It's not only music either. I mean, how long ago was it that we were talking about the medical breakthroughs that were achieved with light therapy? You know, back in the 50s and 60s. And then mm-hmm. you've got some of the other things that were investigated, like, what the heck is the name of that other stuff? It's radio something, where, you know, the body is treated by just manipulating the field structures. It just goes on and on and on. You go all the way back to the shaman who goes and looks at the... He takes a certain plant that gives him the sensitivity to see the aura in great detail, and he'll examine your non-physical body, your etheric body, and see that there's a problem already developing there, which actually has its origins in the mind or in the spirit, and he'll attack it from that point of view before it manifests in the physical body. And this is a method that's tens of thousands of years old. It's used all over the world, even in very primitive areas. It's still in use,
mm-hmm.
and yet, it really is the hallmark of a very advanced knowledge. Because while the pharmaceutical industry provides ammunition for treating symptoms on a very mundane level by putting chemicals into the body which alter its electrochemical activity, that's all manipulations on the material plane. They don't even acknowledge that there's an astral body, or that the mind-body link is responsible for the origin of disease. If they do know about it, it's kept in a vault somewhere. That's the last thing they want people to be thinking about.
Well, I think they do know about it. I think they're intentionally creating substances that interfere or cause an unnatural separation between for lack of a better word, the filaments that attach those three realities to each other. You know,
if
you put a herd of horses in a field and surround it with a corral fence, the horse can still see what's beyond the fence. So it doesn't feel like it's enclosed in that space, even though it knows that it can only go so far if it can't jump the fence. Now, if you build a brick wall around it 20 feet high, you're gonna cause a myriad of problems to occur just because the horses are going to become unhappy, and it's unnatural for them to have their field of vision restricted and to be enclosed, you know, like somebody in a straitjacket. In essence, it's going to do the same thing. You know, what we're talking about here is frequency. All these things, the drugs alter our frequency, and they usually lower our frequency, keeping us on the physical scale. And that's when you talk about a shaman, you're speaking about someone who is already looking at it from the perspective of a higher frequency, and his intention is to raise the frequency of his patient or his subject. So,
I agree with that. And actually, our whole method of I hate to use the word culture, because it's actually anti-culture, but the so-called culture that we embrace in the modern world actually also has a very negative effect on the abilities of human beings, and I believe it's designed to do just that. You know, getting back to what you just said about the horses tolerating a corral but being greatly affected by a wall. Well, actually, the reason for that is because the wall separates them from the totality of which they are naturally a part. And without that connection, they are not truly a horse anymore, any more than any other creature taken completely out of his environment is not truly the creature he's meant to be. He may look the same, and he may still act in a similar manner, but in order for him to be what God intended him to be, he has to be part of a greater gestalt. And we are separated from our world to the point where we don't even recognize what we are, never mind what we could be. And this is a very interesting problem because it winds up causing such a fracture between the naturally intended mode of activity and what we settle for, that we don't even realize is a separation. You talk about what mankind has lost in the Garden of Eden. I mean, this is the kind of thing that it's lost. It's lost its connection to the real world, mm-hmm. to the higher worlds.
Is that fracture a chasm, or is it an abyss?
Oh, my God, I don't know. But I think it's, let's put
maybe
it this
part
way,
of both.
way bigger than a crack. A perfect example of how that works, Don, is in this interesting experiment that was done with rabbits not that long ago either. I think it was in the 90s. And they found that rabbits in their natural environment will avoid poisonous plants. You know, there's lots of nightshade plants that grow all over the place that are quite poisonous. They can kill human beings, so I'm sure they can kill a rabbit. But the rabbit just doesn't eat them. It's not like he went to rabbit school to learn not to eat nightshades, but for some reason he knows not to eat them. Well, what's really interesting is, you know, as long as he's in these open fields running around with his friends, he will not eat anything that will harm him. The minute that you put him in a cage and you put stuff in front of him that is the only food supply that he has, he winds up eating the very stuff he avoids in the outdoors and winds up killing himself. Now, you know, maybe that's because he's so hungry he has no choice, but on the other hand, maybe it's because he's disconnected from the whole. And this brings to mind, what are we disconnected from? What are we no longer a part of that would have changed us into much different beings than we are now? There isn't a human being alive today that you can talk to who doesn't realize at some level that he is completely unhappy, completely dissatisfied, and knows things are wrong in his life, but he can't put his finger on it. Isn't that
so? Yeah, and there are many, many presidents of countries that fall into that category, too. The very people that are ruling us. I mean, talk about the pot calling the kettle black. You know, these are, well, you know, I think part of the answer, you and I have talked about this before, is, you know, consciousness is limitless on the upscale. And it's definitely got a bottom, and this system here is constantly trying to compress us toward that bottom. Like you talk about the one or the two dimensional line as the reality, and that's really where we're headed. We're heading in that direction. That would make anyone unhappy. I'm sure, even that rabbit.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what kind of fate we're in for, but the point is, as long as we've got the ability to fight back with, you know, with the truth and with inspirations of various types, then that's our God-given right, and it's our responsibility to do so.
Yeah. Jim, before we close out the show, and we went over as usual, but it's interesting. I'm not chastising you at all. We began talking about Tesla, and to the point we are right now, it seems to me that Tesla was successful at what he did, and I'm being very general in a sense, and in another sense, I'm being specific. And I think you'll understand the meaning when I make this statement, that he set his intention upon the results that he wanted to produce. He made a choice about where he was headed with something that he was creating. And the power of his intention was quite unusual for his time. And I think if he were here today, he would still surpass anyone else out there. Now, there's some pretty prolific scientists. You are one also. But I'm saying just the nature of the type of individual he was. And maybe that's wrong for me to say that. Maybe there are a million scientists around the world that have that capacity. But I'm speaking in terms of where he was and how deep, how profoundly he understood all of these really, really advanced concepts. He was intuitive. The pattern is that I see that he set his intention on every single project that he worked on, whether he was experimenting in a lab or actually developing something. It's as though if you said, can you turn a grasshopper into a helicopter? He would come up with a way to do that. He was that type of scientist. Now, maybe that's not the best example in the world, but I'm just being ridiculous for the point of making that leap. what is your feeling about our intention? Because I think that's something we've lost. We've lost our power because we've abandoned intention. We misunderstand our true nature. And you've alluded to it in several ways. I mean, the dumbing down through the education, the misuse of the language is definitely a way for us to miss out on the power that is in intention. And, you know, what are your feelings on that? Can you sort of wrap this whole discussion up with an uplifting comment about intention and how we could refocus? Because I know you have intention. I mean, you're expressing it in a multitude of ways.
Well, I can tell you this from personal experience. First of all, it's definitely part of universal law that energy pumped into intention, regardless of its purpose, will eventually bring about the desired result. Absolutely true. This is a basic the basic law that governs all of magic, all of metaphysics, and actually all of our physical lives, whether we're conscious of it or not. And I can tell you that when I was a kid, I discovered this on my own, or at least I was conscious of the mechanism. And I used to pump so much energy into the objects of my desires that they almost always came true, with very, very few exceptions. But an example that I can give you is that I used to lay in bed at night and visualize in my mind some contraption that I wanted to build or some project that I was involved with. And I would picture it and think about it and actually fall asleep thinking about it. Then the next day I'd be up and out scouring junkyards for parts, asking people about stuff. And everything I did was done with the intention of getting me closer to my objective. And it's a conscious, deliberate, and continuous effort. It isn't one of these things where you say, gee, I wish I had that, and then you go on about your everyday life and you don't do anything about it. If you ever get it, it'll be a real miracle. But if you want to be at the helm of your own life, then you have to continuously do this. If you can start with little things, and develop the discipline and the ability to focus to the point where your goals become larger and larger, and eventually you'll be able to use this force of intention to achieve anything that you want. But I mean, just pick something, you know, like a set of golf clubs or some kind of a new stereo for your car or whatever. It may initially seem to be outside your means, okay, but of course the credit card has destroyed a lot of this. In the old days, what we would do is put a picture on the wall in our room of the object of our desire, and then if it was something you could purchase, you would wander around the streets picking up soda bottles, cash them in, put a few cents in a jar, and do odd jobs, put a few more cents in the jar, and you keep on motivating yourself by looking at that picture of whatever it was you wanted to buy. And then one day, sooner or later, you'd have enough money in the jar that you could go and get the thing. Well, that might be a crummy example, but it encapsulates the mechanism very nicely. Whatever you want, you have to constantly keep in the focus of your mind, and you have to direct all of your energies and activities and all of your thinking towards the achievement of that goal. And if you do that religiously, the universe will yield to you. Sooner or later, you will have that object of your desire. Now, here is my closing remark. Having said those things to you, please realize that this is exactly what the enemy does to you. This world was gained control by inch, manipulation by manipulation, buying out the senator, buying out that congressman, lobbying for support from such and such a group. Everything that was done with the intention of eventually controlling everything. And so even the enemy makes use of this, and there's no reason why we can't do it too. Isn't that right, Don? This is a very ancient concept. Nothing
yes.
new about it.
Yes, and in fact, when we put our intention together, when we combine our intention in a way, and you mentioned universal law, which is in sync with universal law, then we will magnify the outcome of that possibility. What comes to mind in my personal space is intending love, intending peace, intending abundance, intending real freedom, intending creativity, intending everything that is good to bring the balance to something which was intended by the Creator. And if we do that, I think it's the very thing you're talking about. And we will find answers to our problems. We will almost immediately solve our problems. We won't even have a reason to have a problem. I think we are that powerful. I don't know.
Well, that's part of the problem. People don't realize just how much in God's image we are made. You know, they have been dumbed down to the point where they are helpless. Not because they're truly helpless, but because they believe they are. They turn to the government, the almighty government, to give you everything you need. When in fact, they don't give you a damn thing. As a matter of fact, all they do is take.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
So the real power lies within us. And if it's dormant, it needs to be woken up. And once you've become aware of the fact that, you know, these are things we can do, then, like you say, if you work with the grain of the universe, and if you go with the flow, a few single-minded individuals can achieve more than a legion of evil people who are working against the flow. But you have to have faith and persistence. That's the secret.
Well, I'm sure, Jim, if I could talk to Nikola Tesla right now, or if I could see him, I would guess he's smiling down on you for the words that you brought to Evident Footprints tonight. And I look forward to further conversations and dialogues like the one we had tonight. This was very uplifting to hear everything you had to say. Just your scientific acumen and the inventions that you have, particularly the Dynaflux generator, I think is something that would benefit mankind immensely. And I had the thought at one point while you were talking about some of these topics that we are moving into the area of simulcasting, where people will be able to watch Evident Footprints as well as listen to it. And I think it would be fantastic for us to do a show and feature one of your or more of your inventions on this show, to let people see that this is a reality, that you are a prolific inventor and you're not just somebody blowing a lot of hot air. And what you just concluded with sums up everything, my feelings, and I'm sure much of the listening audience, their perspective. And you showed us a way, you provided a solution, and all people have to do is, if they're a little bit unsure about what you said, listen to the archive. Go back and listen to the archive and give it some thought. Those of you that recall what you heard, put it to use. It works. And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm finished.
I was going to say, that's really the best proof. No, don't listen to me. Go try it. You know, when you embrace a law that God has made, the proof of its existence lies in the fact that it yields a result to you. So that's just like praying over your food or having a singularity of thought or any number of other metaphysical concepts, which are just as valid as the laws we find in physics books.
Mm-hmm.
But if people are not familiar with them and they want to have a reason to believe in them, the best way to do it is to just try it. Certainly can't hurt you.
Absolutely. And just a reminder to the listening audience, if you like to see one of Jim's larger inventions, I have on a page on my website, directlightproductions.com, a whole series of photos of a dual synchronous capacitor that Jim designed for Bethlehem Steel, and you can actually see the thing being assembled. It's a pictography, I guess you could call it, right, of your work. And there are also a couple of shots of some of a saucer on there too, flying saucer. Now, I don't know if people are going to that page to look at the saucer or everything on there, Jim, but I can tell you a lot of people have looked at those photos, which shows that there's a tremendous interest in that. And much like the B-side of a 45, even though the A-side might become a hit, the B-side sells just as much. It's on the other side of the same record. And,
well, I got that.
So for the listening audience, you're welcome to peruse Jim's photos there. And I'm still waiting for some more. I know you've been very busy, but if you have a chance to give us some other things to look at, I know people will be very interested. You've had a lot of people look at those photos.
Well, as I told you, I will be going back to my native state of New Jersey sometime before Christmas. And with any luck, I'll be able to look in my own archives and find some equally interesting material, which I'll be happy to share with you, Don.
Okay. Well, Jim, thank you so much for being on the show tonight and all the wonderful information and the spiritual insight to all these issues as well. We're going to say goodnight to our listening audience and let them know Jim Murray will be back again next week on Friday, as usual. And special thanks to Don Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and Seth Hendrick on the sound. Sound was great tonight. except for the point where Jim said I was breaking up. That's Skype. That's the interference we get sometimes. We work through it. And I want to thank the listening audience for tuning in. Be sure to tune in next week. Got some great guests lined up. Also, a small reminder, former Los Angeles prosecutor and author of Helter Skelter and Till Death Do Us Part is going to be on Evident Footprints on August 20th, Mr. Vincent Bugliosi, and he will be discussing his new book, The Impeachment of George W. Bush for Murder. You are going to want to hear that show. It's going to be a two-hour special. And in the meantime, I wish everyone a wonderful weekend and a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.